Wherever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zemer. It's my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Justin Cheka, who's serving as our worship associate, our director of religious education, Karen Lapidus, our music director, Hal Walker, and two of our musical groups, our adult peace choir and tone chimers.
Our chalice lighting this morning comes from Scott Prinsner. We wander amid the rubble of the world that is always crumbling and rebuilding, carrying hearts that are constantly breaking and renewing. In this gloom, we kindle one small flame that we might gather our light and our strength for the work that awaits us. The prophets warned us of those who say, "Peace, peace," when there is no peace. And so we join our hearts this morning, not in peace, but in wakefulness. May the light of our shared chalice burn brightly, inspiring us to see clearly and to act with love. May I please have my volunteers? I picked them out beforehand because I didn't think anybody would raise their hand, so. I know you guys. So I love the universe. I love the stars. I love everything in it. It just fills me with absolute wonder to look up at the skies and think about everything that's up there and our place in the universe. And so I wanted to try to fill you folks with a sense of wonder this morning. So a problem that we have, and I guess it's not really a problem, but when we look at the pictures of the earth and celestial bodies and everything, we can't quite grasp the magnitude of how big these things really are. Because nobody understands all that space in between different things. So when you look at a picture of the earth and the moon, oh, sorry, I had you guys in the wrong spot. You know, you usually see something like this. And while the relative sizes are okay, that might not necessarily be correct. And then when you see pictures of, like, the sun and the earth, you see pictures like this. Okay, so you guys stand back up. So what's good to try to understand kind of can also harm our education of how we perceive things. So I've brought in some demonstration items. So a good contrast of the earth and the moon is a tennis ball and a basketball. And so these are the relative sizes. So next time you're playing tennis or basketball, you'd be like, hey, I'm playing with the earth. So these are about the relative size. So, you know, we saw the picture of the earth and the moon. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask my volunteers, tell me where you think in space, since these are about the same size, where you think the moon is. Okay, next volunteer. Can you take the tennis ball? I'm not saying if you're right or wrong yet. And you tell me where you think the moon is. Okay, my last volunteer. You're brilliant! That is where the moon is in relation to the earth. So when you see those pictures, you can't quite understand that distance because there's so much space. And we can't take pictures that big because nobody would get it. So thank you to my volunteers. I need you for one more second. So then the next demonstration is we have the sun. Okay. Now the relative size, like we saw, of the sun and the earth is actually this. This is a marble. This is the sun. This is how big they technically are scaled down to size. Okay, so first volunteer, where do you think the earth is? Yes! All right, I no longer need volunteers.
That's because you said I was
But there's a caveat, because that's kind of a trick question. So if the sun was right here, the earth would actually be all the way down by the river. So we're talking across the street, across the parking lot, all the way down by the river. So that is the relative distance to the sun. So the other cool thing to think about is, okay, so we have this sun. And it's a normal sun. It's a normal star. It's not special in any way. There's thousands and trillions and billions of them just like it. But we also have 100 trillion stars in our galaxy. So if you were to imagine that this whole room is the Milky Way galaxy full of its 100 trillion stars, our star would be no bigger than the head of this pen. So that gives you kind of a scale of things. So, you know, what's the point of it? You know, you try to wonder about the size and you try to grasp it, and you really can't. You can't understand one with 12 zeros. You can't understand that. But what you can understand is the fact that we are alive and we live on this teeny, teeny, tiny planet in this giant cosmic sea. And we get to have these experiences that we call life. And I think that's pretty special. So come and let us worship together.
This congregation is in the midst of a multi-year effort to expand our space, and it's rooted in our vision statement. So to remind us where we're headed, will you please join me in reading our congregation's vision statement this morning? It's printed in your order of service. Our vitality and passion call us to restore and expand our space to equal the energy of our dreams. As we do, we are better equipped to carry on our historic legacy and embrace our potential for connection, service, programming, and outreach.
This morning we are beginning our exploration of wonder for the month of December. We will consider what is beautiful, what is powerful, what is mysterious, what is wonderful. And in this box, I have something that makes me wonder. In this box, I have fire. Well, not exactly, but I have all the things I need to create fire. And this is what science tells us about fire. Science tells us that we need fuel, and the wick of this candle is the fuel. It becomes consumed. The wax is only to slow down the consumption and the burning. Science also tells us that we need oxygen, the oxygen that's in the air, in order for fire to happen. And science also tells us that we need a source of ignition, a spark of energy, and in this case, it's the spark from the match. And those three things together create fire. And yet, even though we can understand the science of fire, it doesn't make it any less wonderful. It's still beautiful and mysterious. And I often wonder what it would have been like for our earliest ancestors, those prehistoric humans, to encounter fire for the very first time. I imagine that the fire would have been from a lightning strike. And I imagine that they would have been frightened. But I also imagine that they would have been filled with wonder by the fire's warmth, beauty, and power. And I often wonder what it might have been like for our later ancestors who had learned to use fire to make their lives easier. Those ancestors who lived before the times that we had electricity and gas to light and heat our homes, and who cooked with fire and lit their homes with candles. And I wonder what it would have been like for them on days like today when it is cold outside and the sun goes down so early, leaving us with long, dark nights. Fire was so important to those ancestors. One of the properties of fire that I've noticed is that when you share it, it does not diminish. This flame is still as bright as it was before it lit this candle. And that's pretty wonderful, isn't it? Maybe we can think about fire as a metaphor or a symbol for love. Just as when one candle is lit from another without taking away any of that first one's flame, love grows in the same way. When love is shared, it grows and grows. So I invite you to wonder this holiday season as fire warms you and lights your way through the dark and long nights, and to wonder how sharing love can also warm all of us through the dark and long nights. And a bit of science before the children and teachers leave, I'm going to briefly take away the oxygen from this equation.
We're just exemplifying the rationale for our expansion need. a time of silence, meditation, and prayer this morning, I chose to share with you words from Maya Angelou. This is an excerpt from her longer poem, A Brave and Startling Truth. We, this people, on a small and lonely planet, traveling through casual space, past aloof stars, across the way of indifferent suns, to a destination where all the signs tell us it is possible and imperative that we learn a brave and startling truth. And when we come to it, to the day of peacemaking, when we release our fingers from fists of hostility and allow the pure air to cool our palms, we, this people, on this small and drifting planet whose hands can strike with such abandon that, in a twinkling, life is sapped from the living, yet those same hands can touch with such healing, irresistible tenderness, that the haughty neck is happy to bow and the proud back is glad to bend, out of such chaos, of such contradiction, we learn that we are neither devils nor divines. When we come to it, we, this people, on this wayward floating body, created on this earth, of this earth, have the power to fashion for this earth a climate where every man and every woman can live freely without sanctimonious piety, without crippling fear. When we come to it, we must confess that we are the possible, we are the miraculous, the true wonder of this world. That is when, and only when, we come to it. Keep silence for a few moments together. How is it with my spirit? How is it with yours? How is it with our spirits this morning as we gather? Are you a little weary of the dark and cold already? Weary of the trials and tribulations of your own life. Weary of the losses and burdens you carry on your shoulders. Are you frightened today? Angry? Confused how it continues? Racism, sexism, classism. So many violences, little and large, that rain down upon people, chip away at the foundation of dignity for each and all. How is it with my spirit, and how is it with yours? We gather this morning to be lifted up. Let the sun streaming through these windows this morning brighten us. And let the light shining in these people around us inspire us, lift us up a little bit higher, open our hearts a little bit wider. Remind us that when the light is shared, it isn't diminished, but grows. Let us take inspiration from the light of one another. And remember, when this day is done, that we have light, light that is needed by the people we meet, by our community, by our world. Let us not neglect to share our light. Amen, and blessed be. Thank you.
Okay. So now that you guys know that I'm a nerd, one of my heroes, or one of the people I'd most like to have lunch with, is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He is an astrophysicist, the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. He recently did a reboot of the Cosmos that Carl Sagan did back in the day. He just seems like a pretty good guy, right? But what's really gravitating about him is his energy and his enthusiasm and the way he says things and the perspectives that he can give. And I've always found that very encapsulating. So in my study of the universe and, you know, the cosmos and everything, it can get a little daunting, you know, thinking about sizes and about us, you know. You can't comprehend the magnitude, but you just feel small, you know. And then, you know, I'm doing my research, you know, it's just a hobby, so I don't know if I could do research. Anyway, so, you know, then I read, you know, that the sun's going to burn up the earth in 5 billion years, so it's like, so it's so encapsulating, and you feel overwhelmed, and, you know, and you're like, what's the point, you know? So I came across an interview that he had done with Time magazine, and I think it lends a lot of perspective, and it helped kind of help me deal with the overwhelmingness of it all. And he was asked, "What is the most astounding fact that you know?" And this was his response. "The most astonishing fact. The most astounding fact is the knowledge that the atoms that comprise life on Earth, the atoms that make up the human body, are traceable to the crucibles, the stars, that cooked light elements into heavy elements in their cores under extreme temperatures and pressures. Their stars, these stars, the high-mass ones among them, went unstable in their later years. They collapsed and exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the universe. Guts made of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and all the fundamental ingredients for life. These ingredients then became part of a gas cloud that condensed, collapsed, and formed the next generation of solar system stars with orbiting planets. And those planets now have the ingredients for life itself. So when I look up at the sky, I know that, yes, we are part of the universe. We are in this universe. But perhaps more important than both of those facts is that the universe is in us. So when I reflect on that fact, I look up, and many people feel small because we're small and the universe is so big. But I feel big because my atoms came from those stars. So there's a level of connectivity there. That's really what you want in life. You want to feel connected. You want to feel relevant. You want to feel like a participant in the goings-on and events around you. And that's precisely what we are just by being alive.
So I wonder how many people recognize this image? Just a couple. So this is a picture called the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and it was taken by two cameras aboard NASA's Hubble telescope in 2004. Some of you know all about this already, but for those of you who don't, a little explanation will help you understand what you're looking at. So you've heard of taking a core sample from Earth, drilling down and taking a core sample from Earth. This picture could be understood as taking a core sample of space. So to get an idea of what that might be like, you need the straw that you got today when you came in. If you didn't get one, you can share with a neighbor. So take your straw and just focus it on something here in the sanctuary and look through it. So the image that you see through your straw is a little bit like this image that took this, the process that took this photograph. It's really narrow and really deep. You also need to know that this photograph was taken of a patch of sky that, when it's viewed from Earth-based telescopes, looks practically empty. But with the Hubble telescope's technological advance, this seemingly empty patch of sky revealed almost 10,000 galaxies. That's primarily what you're seeing in this picture. There are a couple of points of light that are stars from our own galaxy, but almost all of the points of light are galaxies made up of hundreds of millions of stars. And one of the truly amazing things about this image is that we can see galaxies in various stages of formation. So again, you need your straw. If you're looking through your straw, you can see things in the up close to you, in the near ground, in the mid ground, and in the background. So the same is true here. So in the near ground, we can see mature spiral and elliptical galaxies. If you came up and looked closely, you'd see galaxies that are the shape that you recognize. And then in the mid-ground, you can see developing galaxies. And then in the background, you can see galaxies that are still forming. And they appear to us in this image as small red points of light. And because of the time that it takes light to travel that distance, so again, imagine this core sample, the light is traveling further from those images that appear further away, those still forming galaxies existed a long, long time ago, about 400 to 800 million years after the Big Bang. We're seeing them as they existed then. And then by contrast, the mature galaxies in this image, we're seeing as they existed about a billion years ago when the cosmos was 13 billion years old. So from these images, scientists have been able to glean a lot of important clues, including about how galaxies evolve over time, and also about what type of objects reheated the cold, dark universe so long ago, amongst many other important things. Anthony Dora is a contemporary novelist, and he says that the president should have a copy of this picture on his desk, and it should hang in every classroom in the country and in every church, too. He says it's the most important photo ever taken for the sense of wonder it stimulates and the window it provides into the incomprehensible vastness of the universe. Remember, this photograph reveals to us what looks like an empty patch of sky from the Earth. And he says that it's kind of impossible for us to fathom this scale of the universe. At any given point in time, there are given or take 10 sextillion stars. Who has any idea what 10 sextillion stars is? And that's kind of incomprehensible. But he tries to break it down for us. So he says that if every single person alive on the Earth right now were charged with naming their share of stars, we'd have to name a star every single time that our heart beat for our whole entire life, and we'd have to live 375 million lifetimes to name our share. The most astounding fact, deGrasse Tyson says, is that we are part of this universe, and we are in this universe, but perhaps most important than both of those facts is that the universe is in us. We are literally stardust. We don't shine in the exact same way, but like these galaxies, our little lives are also points of light in this wondrous universe. So my plan today in introducing this theme of wonderment is to share experiences with you and stories which can evoke our own sense of wonder. And so I thought of a few members of the congregation who engage in passions that I think must have a sense of wonderment at their base. And I wrote to them and asked them if they had any thoughts to share on this subject, and a few responded to me. So I'd like to share some thoughts with you from Randy Leeson. Randy says, "My sense of wonder comes from the incredible complexity and beauty of the physical reality. Each layer of physical reality has a complex beauty of its own, but also sets the stage for the next layer of complexity. From a quark gluon plasma, the particle menagerie emerges. The fundamental forces, gravity, strong nuclear, weak nuclear, and electromagnetic, play between these particles to create everything from atoms to large-scale structures of the universe. From the interactions between the electrons of atoms, chemistry emerges to govern the behavior of our day-to-day world. Our particular atom, carbon, has one particular atom, carbon, has such complex interactions with other atoms that self-replicating structures that we call life emerge onto the stage. There's an unbroken line of life stretching all the way from the first primitive cell to the vast complexity of life on Earth. One type of cell, the neuron, evolved to allow living creatures to process information and react to changes in the environment. From this dance of information exchange between neurons, consciousness emerged. In a very real sense, each of us is an example of the emergent property called consciousness. The rules that allow all this were hidden like gifts in the physical reality at the moment it was created. Science allows us to test, describe, and even manipulate the physical reality. But understanding need not destroy the sense of wonder at the many miracles woven into the fabric of the universe. Understanding the scientific method allows me to be free from beliefs and lets me reshape my worldview as new theories and evidence arrives. This is a great gift, but there is another equally important gift that science gives, a feeling of wonder. The closest thing I have to a spiritual practice, he concludes, is being under a clear dark sky on a moonless night. Anyone watching would only see me fooling around with telescopes, binoculars, maps, and other junk. But my inner world is alive with wonder at the vast beauty of the creation. So Justin sent me a link this week, which I'll share with you in the e-news, to an interactive website where you can click and explore the scale of the universe from the vastest to the most microscopic view. It's super cool. And we're going to make a little shift like that now ourselves, going from this vastness of the cosmos to a tiny little ice crystal, magnified for you so that you can see it. So this ice crystal you see here comes from the collection of Wilson Bentley. Bentley was born into a farming family in 1865 in rural Jericho, Vermont. He was homeschooled by his mother, who had once been a teacher, and his primary text was a set of encyclopedia from her school teaching days. She also had an old microscope, which he was allowed to use as he got a little older, and he loved to explore all manner of little things that he could find in the fields and the forests near his home. He especially loved precipitation, and he liked to look at drops of dew, water, snow, and ice under the microscope. He loved it all, but he especially loved ice crystals. In his early teen years, he spent two winters trying to draw the crystals that he could see under his microscope, but they kept melting before he could finish his pictures. And he also felt that his own abilities were a poor rendering of what he could see, and he wanted other people to be able to see this beauty. So when he read about this camera that existed that could take photos through a microscope, he knew he had to have it. So he talked to his mom, and together they approached his father to lobby him to purchase this special equipment. And his father, these people were farmers, his father didn't understand why on earth they should spend the amount of money it would cost to buy 10 cows on a piece of equipment that would be of no use in farming. But in time, the mother and the son prevailed, and the family purchased a Bellows camera with microscope. Now, Bentley didn't know anything about photography, so he had to learn how to use this thing himself, and he spent over a year figuring it out through trial and error. Finally, after over a year, Bentley captured his first photomicrograph of an ice crystal. The day was January 15, 1885, and he was just a month away from his 20th birthday. He devoted the rest of his life to studying precipitation in all its forms, and he would work long hours, especially during snowstorms. Over the years, he made thousands and thousands of photomicrographs, and he wrote articles for popular publications about the things that he was learning and observing from his studies of all kinds of precipitation, but especially ice crystals. And he learned a lot about how the formation of ice crystals is affected by their journey through the atmosphere. Just a few years before he died, he received recognition which he had not gotten in his life because he didn't have a degree. Most scientists kind of distance themselves from him and his work, but just a couple years before he died, the chief physicist of the United States Weather Bureau realized that he wanted to ensure that these photographs were captured. I'll show you a few more. And so he raised the money for Bentley to create a book called Snow Crystals, which contains 2,500 images of the snow crystals that he collected over his lifetime, and it's still available today. Since his death, Bentley's work has become much more widely appreciated by scholars, artists, and the people of his town, too. When he was alive, they didn't really get what he was doing. These were farming people. He was out chasing after snow, and he tried to show them. You know, he would set up little screenings of, like, put a sheet over a clothesline, but most people didn't come. They weren't particularly interested in what he was doing. But since he's died, more people have come to understand his work. And now the people of Jericho keep a special exhibit of his in the Historical Society. And people from all over traveling through Vermont stop to look at the amazing collection of ice crystals. So though he wasn't particularly well understood or appreciated in his lifetime, the thing that I find amazing is that he understood what he was doing. So these are his words. He said, "The average dairy farmer gets up at dawn because he has to go work in the cow yard. I get up at dawn, too, but it's because I want to find some leaf hung with dew or a spider web which the dew has made into the most delicate ropes of pearls. I take my camera with me, get down on my knees in the wet grass, and photograph these exquisite bits of nature. Because I do this, I can show these lovely things to people who would never have seen them without my help. They'll get their daily quart of milk, all right. Other farmers will see to that. But I think I'm giving them something which is just as important. He was giving them, and now us, a window into beauty and wonder. So another member of the congregation I wrote to this week is Paulette Thurman, who's a gardener. She cultivates astounding beauty in her yard. Ask her to invite you in the springtime. It's amazing. And this is what she had to say. Wonder is a lot like God, isn't it? It's all in the definitions and the experiences thereof. And then the relationship with wonder. So is wonder the beginning of God, or is wonder just the opposite of death? Wonder inspires so many questions. That's why we call it wonder. As a lifelong gardener, more than the wonder in seeing flowers bloom is the wonder of the actual soil, the dirt, the wonderful feel of the soil, the way the plants, way before the plants grow and bloom and perfume the air, the wonder of hands in the dirt, the feel of that. And so I wonder, do you have any practices which enable you to reach out and touch wonder, to feel it in your hands, to hear it, to smell it, to taste it, or see it in all its glory? There are endless ways to give ourselves over to wonder. So one more story for you from Ed Stolish, a member of our congregation. He's a fly fisherman, and this picture is going to help us with his thoughts. He says he's a catch-and-release fly fisherman, which means he doesn't keep or kill anything he catches. He prefers to fish for trout in mountain streams or rivers. Trout usually live in areas of natural beauty whose waters are not polluted and are well oxygenated. I try to pitch my tent within the sound of rushing water. Of particular interest to trout are mayflies. Trout feed upon mayflies during every stage of the mayfly's life. A mayfly starts out as an egg on the bottom of the stream. Soon the egg hatches and many little legged creatures called nymphs emerge and begin roaming around on the bottom of the stream. Almost to the day it began life as an egg, the nymph is ready to become a full-fledged mayfly. The nymph sheds its old skin, rises to the surface, sprouts wings, dries itself off, and for the first time flies. Millions of mayflies may hatch on a single stream. Fly fishermen refer to this event as a hatch. If the mayfly survives the hatching and the wing drying stage, it heads for a stream, side bush, or tree where its trail grows longer and its wings become clear. Soon, the spinners fly over the water and mate in midair. After doing his assigned job, the male drops to the surface of the stream and dies. The female then deposits her eggs in the stream to start the cycle all over again. The drying spinner is referred to by fly fishermen as a spinnerfall, and this, if you can see, is what that looks like. And it's considered the best time to fish for gorging trout. One evening, Ed says, I encountered a heavy spinnerfall on a mountain stream, but I was so amazed by the experience that I was unable to fish, so I wrote this haiku. Silver rings at dusk. The mayflies have spent their lives. Now the trout will feed. He ends his piece with a observation that he knows, he's convinced that there is a connectivity in the universe. And like Ed, I too am convinced of that connectivity, convinced that we're part of something so much larger than ourselves. We're connected to everything in this universe, to star and to snowflake and soil and every living being. In the brief span that is our lives, we have the opportunity to ponder these gifts of connectedness, to wonder about all that is of this universe and our place among the whole. Wondering happens best when we have a little time and a little space. December is a good time to practice wondering, filled as it is with pine trees and twinkling lights, filled as it is with dark windows illuminated by the flame of the menorah, by dark nights illuminated by the fire of the Yule log. The holidays and holy days this month invite us to pause and wonder about the stories and symbols and rituals we keep. And something in the magic and the mystery touches us. Though we hear them every year, even the littlest stories of generosity, the kind that get put in the local paper about the third grader who takes a tag off the giving tree at school and raises the money from her allowance and chores to buy something for another child, even those stories Even though we expect them and know they happen every year, they touch us and move us. Stories of generosity and community and peacemaking. And we're all inspired by the impulse to reach out and bless that springs forth from so many hearts in December. So this December, we approach the holiday season while a national crisis unfolds around us. And it's been a little confusing for me. Emotions are running high, anger and grief, fear and resistance, fear and uncertainty, fatigue and resolve. All these we see on the news every day in the faces of people we know and maybe even feel in ourselves. Emotions are running high and the holidays are fast upon us. And so I wonder if this year we might find a way together to extend the impulse to generosity and community beyond its usual confines. I wonder if we can find a way to be generous in our efforts to understand the perspective of those who are testifying now to their suffering. I wonder if we can find a way to speak to the importance of trust, equality, and respect in all of our communities. I wonder if when we sing the carols, songs of peace, we can remember that peace requires justice. And I wonder if we can find a way, however small, to help bend that moral arc of the universe a little bit more toward justice. Where did we come from? Where are we going? How will we get there? December is a good month for wondering. So I invite you to give yourself the time and the space that wondering requires to see what opens for you. Let your little light shine in yourself and then find a way to share it. Amen and blessed be.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and for you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of clouds of white, bright blessed day, and the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They'll learn much more I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
I send you with these words from Sarah Moores Campbell. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, go boldly into the unknown. Go in peace.